So hello, everyone. You're all very welcome here this afternoon to the McLally Theater. My name is Charlotte MacIver, and I lecture in drama and theater studies at University of Galway. It is my privilege to be the facilitator for this panel here this afternoon. I'm going to introduce very briefly the lovely people to my right and to my left. So we're going to go first to Petal. So Petal has a lifetime of experience in theater, having grown up in a traveling theater company, touring extensively throughout Europe, a woman who has seen the world. In your role as artistic director for Blue Teapot, you have commissioned new plays, you have directed theater, as well as working with the ensemble for many years. Blue Teapot has been making work for almost 20 years, blending together the work of your professional ensemble with all the different levels on which the company works with community as well as with those actors. What do you think is the biggest, I suppose, challenge that your company is facing right now? And what are you most excited about?
Well, that's a great introduction. I sound really impressive. Thanks, Charlotte. It's a big question. So some of the biggest challenges that we face as always, even though we've grown and the team has grown, is how much we spend. And so because I suppose the our artists would even today not have as much available at their fingertips in terms of connecting into the arts, I suppose we feel an obligation to give a meaningful experience to people with intellectual disabilities from a very young age. So we're constantly looking to meet and go out and meet people at a younger age and to span all ages. And as you mentioned, that there's a lot in that. So and to give very good quality experiences to people. And that takes a lot, as you know. And I was just talking to Grania before we got started about, you know, because Blue Teapot spans the arts, we are an arts organisation, but also we have stakeholders in health and disability services and in education in terms of keeping all of those people happy and reporting back. That's huge. It's huge for an organisation, and we're a small team. I mean, a great team, but a small team.
And with all those plates spinning, what do you feel is your biggest need right now?
Time is such a valuable commodity, isn't it? So we do have plates spinning. I mean, there are wonderful people within the staff team of Blue Teapot, our artists, our students, and a lot of external contractors. And we're lucky, we live in Galway, so that is, you know, it's a city of art. So that's a huge resource for people. I think that time and space, I can't underestimate how important it is when you want to create quality and you want to have a deep connection to the work you make, to the trajectory of a student's three-year experience with the company, the community projects that you connect into. That you need distillation time, and you know, we live in the world, we're not unique, we live in the world, but we do, where it's a constant go, but if you want to create artistic meaning in your life as an individual or on stage, I think that's a really valuable commodity.
And speaking of time, roughly a year ago, you sat on a similar stage talking about the new project that Blue Teapot was embarking on, creating your first show for young audiences and also a series of workshops facilitated by your actors within your ensemble.
Yep.
So your first group of workshops launches tomorrow. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the project that you all are bringing into the sector from Blue Teapot?
Yeah, so like we're so learning because we haven't made work for young audiences. Kieran is one of our ensemble actors. He'll speak for himself in a minute, but we developed a training with Ali Morris, who's deeply connected in the past to Babro, in terms of our actors delivering workshops directly to children of mixed ability in schools. And so we've been brewing that idea, haven't we, over about 18 months, Kieran? Mm-hmm. And tomorrow we go live with our first school. So we've got three city schools coming into Blue Teapot, about 12 children, disabled, non-disabled kids coming in, and Kieran and seven other ensemble members are taking different groups of children through a workshop process. And then we're going into the county as well. So very exciting.
So Kieran, yes. That leads me to introduce you. You're an actor of the stage and screen. Audiences may recognize you from starring in Christian O'Reilly's Sanctuary, mm-hmm. as well as starring as Lysander in Midsummer Night's Dream. You have a wealth of experience as an actor. What have been your best moments in your acting work?
Well, I've done some from street parades to Sanctuary to Cinders to really everything I can think of in Blue Tree Flat. I have great experience. I'm just happy to be part of Blue Tree Flat. It's like a home. Oh, it's like a home to all of us there, and it's an amazing place to work with.
So you spoke to me in Petal about wanting more opportunities for inclusive casting. Do you want to talk to us about what that means for you?
Well, for me, I want to see a lot more of people that are a mixture of Malayan people and people with disabilities.
And what excites you about working with other folks in that way?
Just knowing that they live in the community and they can come together and form a group that they can do anything that they want to.
And how do you feel about going out and doing your workshops from tomorrow?
Well, I'm doing one on Thursday with another colleague in Tupac, and it's going well. We enjoy the workshops with Petal, and we're doing shows coming up in November to December called The Fairy Tree. Mm.
And what would you want audiences to know about that show?
That's for the kids mostly, just to they can come and see the sort if they want to. The fairy tree is, it's basically magical. Mm. It creates magic, and it just gives to everyone. A chance to be like everyone else. Have the same rights as people with able or disabled.
And how do you feel about kids in the audience for the first time as an actor?
Well, I was born with Downs, and I am just happy being what I'm doing now. As you said, I have done nearly everything I could think of. I've been on, I've done street parades to films like Sanctuary, which was important to me. And getting a lot of change was also important to me. With people with, not just with Downs, but with anyone who had Downs or other types of disabilities, mm-hmm. that are able to be cast in any role they want. And I want to see a lot more of them and a mixture of both, vulnerable and people with disabilities doing theatre and TV acting and just seeing them in general. What they want to do, what they want in our life, that's what I want in our life.
Thank you, Kieran, and thank you for being such a leader in the field there. Over to another leader in the world of acting and performance. You may have seen her on stage this week in Jodie O'Neill's Grace. I have the pleasure of introducing Eleanor Walsh, who is a performer and, like Kieran, an autism and disability advocate. She graduated from the DIT Conservatory of Music and Drama, and her recent credits include Yellow, also with Jodie O'Neill, Daughter of God with Asylum Productions, What I Don't Know About Autism, also with Jodie O'Neill, and several other productions at the Abbey. She consults on relaxed performance and autistic representation and inclusion, and is a youth ambassador for As I Am. So you are in the middle of a run, Eleanor, so probably quite tired by this point in the day, and you built on a busy few years in multiple productions and working as a performance consultant. What's been the biggest win for you artistically during this time?
Getting to work on and be a part of What I Don't Know About Autism, which was written by Jodie here a few years ago, was a huge win, not only because it brought relaxed performance and sensory friendly theatre to brand new audiences and brand new communities, as it was the first relaxed performance and relaxed production in the Abbey, but also but also because it was a really funny and moving play that had autistic people and autistic culture in Ireland at its centre, and it is really, really unique, and was really something that and was a really formative experience as well, not only creatively but also in kind of presenting myself as a as an autistic actor, and not just an actor really for the first time, which I wasn't sure I would be able to do when I was doing my drama training. I wasn't sure if that was a sensible idea, but you know, it was really but with that it became, you know, something that I could own. I really, like, in my head and in my life, there's really like a big dividing line between pre what I don't know about autism and post what I don't know about autism. and then I have to mention Grace as well, because it's my first time working with Graffiti Theatre Company, and getting and having the honour of being one of the many, many people representing them and their work in their 40th year is I feel very privileged to be able to do that, and it's also my first like experience getting to work and make theatre for children and young people. Last year I also was able to tour another piece of Jodie's called Yellow in schools around Dublin 15. And that's a really beautiful play, and I'm mentioning it because we were aware during that tour of how, like, oftentimes when people go into schools to show students something about society or whatever, and this is in secondary schools, if it's in any way connected to disability or people that are different, it's often talking, you know, it's other people talking about us, and you know, and I was kind of aware that, like, for a lot of the students, this, you know, I might be the first, like, disabled actor they'd meet in person, or like even just being able to show, like, that this is one of the ways in which disabled and autistic people can be, especially because it's such though we've made great gains over the past few years with knowledge and acceptance, it's still there's still a lot of misunderstandings and stereotypes and stigma, and that in itself, I'm aware of that in all of the theatre work I do, that that I have a slightly different job to the other actors on stage with me. It's this job, it's representing my community, which I feel very privileged to have the opportunity to do, as long as they let me.
So Eleanor, I'm so struck by what you said about that dividing line in your life between I'm an actor versus I'm going to be clear that I'm an autistic actor, and part of your work is to do the plays, but then to also consult in the industry. What have you learned from within your work as an actor that you would like to put back on the theater industry to think about?
time and information are two huge and oftentimes invisible and underrated things that we can provide and share for to make things and to make processes more accessible. And I think there can be a lot of fear or nervousness for good reason sometimes about engaging with disabled audiences or artists or art. You know, the fear of getting things wrong is a powerful one. And but I think you know, if it's when that you let that fear petrify and paralyze you, that it ends up, you know, not being respectful anymore. And that and I think companies and venues and organizations can be should do more to reach out and learn and not be afraid of learning and not being afraid of trying and failing and trying again. I think also another thing that the industry could do to make things more accessible to disabled artists is maybe to stop means testing disability allowance, because and other people in the panel or in the audience might have more to say about this, but it can be like a big barrier to disabled artists becoming professional artists and getting on that path. Because if, you know, because there are rules about how much a person can, how much money a person can make through employment if they're also collecting disability allowance. And if those rules are broken, the disability allowance can stop. And so I'm very lucky to work in theatre. Some of the time, and I'm very lucky all of the time I do it, but I only do it some of the time. and a lot of the kind of traditional like working actor or not working actor jobs can be really, you know, and the service jobs can be really inaccessible to disabled people generally, and then that's what, you know, that's part of the reasons why we have disability allowance. But if I get paid using the Arts Council's paying artists fairly policy, then I couldn't get disability allowance. I'm not currently on disability allowance, but I would like to be, but I can't, unfortunately, because I work sometimes. I guess it's just about if I know it's something the Arts Council are aware of, but it does involve other government departments, of course, and it's very complicated. So I don't really know what the situation or the solution is at the moment, apart from just like waiting to see what happens with the basic income, basic art for the artist.
Thanks for that, Eleanor. And you've laid out just a number of issues really clearly and beautifully. And we have a woman over here who will be coming to at the end in terms of policy and plan, has some really clear sight on that through Safe to Create's recent Amplify report. So we'll put a bookmark on that in our brains and come next to Jody O'Neill. So Jody is an autistic writer, performer, and disability activist. advocate as well as a general powerhouse like all the folks on this panel. She was theater artist in residence at UCC and Cork Opera House between 2022 and 2024. She's actively engaged in artist development, offering dramaturgical input, mentorship, and practical support in developing work to other artists. And she advises various organizations on accessibility and relaxed performances. She recently founded The Working Group, an online work and peer support space for neurodivergent artists, and she was a key partner in the inaugural NeuroConvergence event in 2024. So, Jodi, to say that you are a leader is an understatement. You're working on every level as a performer, a writer, a playwright, a producer, and a consultant. So you've seen every side of the production process. Focusing on production specifically, what are some learnings that you've had in terms of how we can embed inclusive practices with and without a budget?
First of all, I don't want to talk about access because I just want to hang out with the babies. But I will. But if I get distracted, that's why. And the second thing to say is that everything that I'll say is based on mistakes and learning from mistakes rather than expertise. So I think that's really important to say, like, oh, there isn't like a shiny guidebook for getting everything right. It's just all trial and error. And the third thing is, I guess, that's doing something is better than doing nothing. So I think I'm going to say a lot of practical stuff, and I feel like that could be overloading for some people and a bit too much information and then kind of off-putting. But I think it's important to say it. But I just think like you can do one of those things. So the first thing that I started to do was relaxed performance. And then I started to realize actually there's lots more that we can do. But it's okay to start with one thing. In terms of production structures, so I think like I've broken it into phases, which I'll probably then abandon halfway through. But I guess it's worth considering access and inclusive practice at a creation phase. So at the writing or devising stage, consider what you would like to do in terms of access. So for example, if you would like to provide audio description, is there a character in the piece who can be an audio describer? Can you embed that in the piece from the outset? Or if it's same if you're using a sign language interpreter, can they be a character? Can they be really integrated in that way? If it's a relaxed performance, make that part of the structure and try to ground it within the world. And the reason to do that, I suppose, is that not just that it's creatively more satisfying, but it will make the whole production process a lot easier from there because you're setting out with what you know you want to do in mind, and then you're working towards how much of that is possible. Three things all the way along. One is, we've already said it, it's in the title of the panel, time is such a huge thing. Budget, not like have a big budget. I mean, great, if you have a big budget, that's fantastic, but what's manageable within the budget and the time frame that you have? And just that communication and information is such a key part of all stages of this process. I think that we need to talk about like casting a little bit more as well. I think we need to talk about changing the traditional structures around casting because they're ableist and they're discriminatory and they're only getting more so. So things like self-tapes are not an accessible way of doing casting. It's not kind to send somebody a script on a Friday afternoon and say, I need this by Monday. It puts people at a great advantage. All kinds of people, disabled and non-disabled. It puts parents at a great advantage, single parents at a great disadvantage. So changing the kind of thinking around casting and looking more towards kind of a workshop casting situation or looking at development time, which I think is such a crucial part of any process that you're hoping to make accessible because you learn so much in that development. And I think also I bang out this analogy all the time because it's so potent for me, but the idea of like a French press coffee thing and that like all the grains settle in between each development time. So there's all this residual learning that can take place from, a stage of the process, even if there seems to be nothing happening in between, there's loads of learning happening during that time. Some practical things that I think are really important is providing every single member of your team with an access rider, like a template for an access statement, and having those read and analyzed for all the relevant detail, and then putting in place access provisions for the team that that correspond to those access riders where possible. I think there are really ideally two key roles that are additional in this creative process. One is if you have disabled cast members, that you have a welfare liaison person who whose sole role it is within the production to look after welfare needs and ensure that relevant information is communicated in a way that's accessible to all members of the team. And then my new discovery is that we also then need an access coordinator, mm-hmm. because there's so many aspects to access and there's so many people that need the information relating to access at all times. So if you can have one person whose role it is to then disseminate and coordinate that information, it's going to make it run much more smoothly for all members of the team. On that, and I think like we ran into major time issues with Grace. We found out that we had the funding just kind of towards the last days of March, mm. and we were opening the show in
6-8 weeks later.
Yeah, in early June. So we had to make the show really, really quickly, and not all the ambitions in terms of access were communicated by me across the entire team, including the designers, the production manager, all of that. So I think we've run into, like, time has kind of put us in a pressure cooker where sometimes we're actually reactive in rather than kind of responsive. And it's to do with kind of having, because I don't feel like the work is undercooked, but I feel like the process has been a little undercooked in places. And I like totally take responsibility for that. Because I think access can become a contentious issue if people feel like their creative work is being compromised in any way by it. And on this production, we've had like huge generosity from everybody in that. But I know that I feel like that in future shows, that's something I'll be really careful to communicate to every person, what my overall vision is in terms of the access of the access and elements of the show, and ensuring that everybody is kind of onboarded from day one with that, and then alongside that, that there's adequate training then provided across those things. Sorry, so a lot of things to still say. Yes. That schedules, like really detailed schedules and really detailed information, might be much more important in a process where access is a thing on both sides in terms of audience and in terms of the creative team. And rehearsal plans and rehearsal spaces are really crucial. Bless you. I think that additional rehearsal time is a key thing, but also possibly shorter rehearsal days. I also think it's really useful. So on Grace, we had like a development week last November or December, right?
Yeah.
And so we discovered a lot about the show then that we had time then to think about, even if we didn't have like budget at that time to do another week. But I think those kind of where you can leave space is a really good thing. So I like to do shows in January as well, so that you can rehearse a little bit in December and then a little bit in January, and then everybody has a little bit of time to think and process in between. But yeah, shorter rehearsal times, a very clear kind of structure for rehearsals, and very clear communication if that has to change for some reason. Additional tech time, I think, is really important, again, on both sides. So I think, additional tech time, but if you are working with disabled cast members, less time for the cast in tech. So hopefully shorter tech days across a longer period of time, I think, makes for a more humane and accessible experience for everybody. How you set out your rehearsal room, how you set out the environment, even if you don't have the luxury of having an extra room that you can use as a quiet space. Graffiti, where we worked, has many, many like invisible rooms where you can make up those spaces. But even for what I don't know about autism, we just had a kind of some mats, right? And that was a take a break space, and anybody knew that they could go there at any time and just take some time out. So I think if you're looking at creatively embedding access, which I would like to do more of in my work, it's sort of recognizing that there's that this has to happen in an ongoing way through rehearsals. So Mo, who's here, who is our audio description consultant on Grace, we kind of got to work a little bit over the summer on the audio description script. But I think what I would have loved and what I would love is to look at like what happens if you have an audio description consultant in the room all of the time. Because even if you're writing into the original script, you're not writing in the blocking. You don't know those things until much later. So they're all things that will morph and will change, and that a good consultant can creatively respond to. And then recognizing how all of these forms of access intersect. So for example, if you're captioning, which I think is a really good, it's a really good and really cheap access provision. You can literally load the script into QLab, break it into cues, and you need an extra person to operate and with a very fast hand. But it does, it greatly increases accessibility for people who have audio processing differences, and then also for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. But again, the captioning integrates with the audio description. So every time the audio description changes, the captioning needs to change. So there's like a huge time factor and a huge kind of consideration in the kind of the web of how these things mesh together and how you manage that in a way that everybody can mostly maintain their sanity throughout the process. I can't read my writing there, but I think it says extra personnel. training for the team, and then in terms of audiences, then again it's information in advance, as much information as you can give and as much time and notice as you can give, engaging directly with target audiences, and that's been and communities, that's been a huge learning thing for us, I think, on this round of Grace, that we'll do differently going forward, and creating a welcoming environment within the venues that you go to. So training staff in-house, because you go somewhere and somebody will, I can say, like somebody has said to me before, oh, I have an autistic nephew, so I know how to do this, but without recognizing that one autistic person is one autistic person. So I think that kind of training that is bespoke to the production actually is kind of the most useful way of doing it, rather than going, well, this is how we do it, therefore you guys are coming in, this might match with what you do, but this is how we do it here. So all of that is a whole other piece of communication that Niall is going to talk more about, right? You did, you said you would talk about menus and now you have to. I just want to talk like very quickly about a show that I made earlier in the year with an artist called Al Bellamy and a group of artists from Swisha Arts in Cork, who are part of Koch Foundation. Yes. On that show, we did have a little bit more time because we had a 2-year development process. So we wrote audio description into the script. It's not perfect, but it's okay for things not to be perfect, I think, as long as you're trying. We did have lots of additional tech time. We also had all our artists engage with the design team. So they co-designed a lot of the elements of it, and where they didn't co-design, they were part of the design workshops. So there was like it was a participatory process. So reducing the kind of number of unknowns when you came into the space, rehearsing in the venue was a really big part of that process as well. And additionally, we had a lot of actors who didn't have capacity to learn lines on that show, who therefore had been kind of relegated to dancing roles in the past, but actually had a lot to say. And so we looked at using earpiece technology. So we worked with the MA students in UCC, and one of them then offered their services as our line feeder, and they fed the lines individually to 8 performers who needed that for access. And it meant that for the first time, these performers could speak at length on stage, and that was a hugely empowering thing, not just for them but for their families as well, I think, and for their peers who came to see it and saw like that person is rocking it on stage. And it was such a simple thing, and it wasn't a hugely expensive thing. And then finally, sorry Niall, with no budget or with less budget, you can still implement all of the elements of relaxed performance. You can still, if you can't, maybe you can maybe you can't do audio description, but maybe you can provide program notes, or maybe you can do audio description if you're working across a much longer time. You can introduce elements of love. You can manage communication with very simple visual guides. Group agreements where it's a participatory process are really important, so that everybody knows what the expectations are of them all of the time, or most of the time. But I think it's almost like the less budget you have, the more time you need. And now I'll stop. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I mean, that was incredible in terms of both the concrete and the visionary, and really your production of Grace now playing. If you haven't seen it, beg, borrow, steal, get there, shows us what is possible when we can dream, but also be concrete about the dreaming. So Niall, as the man who has brought this to the stage along with the team, you are the artistic director and CEO of Graffiti Theater, who I hear is about to have their 40th birthday. The director of Grace and numerous productions for Graffiti and others over the years. You presented work at a number of festivals, including Cork Midsummer, Galway International Arts Festival, Not Your First Babero, Origins NYC, and Connections. You're the chair of TYAI and former chair of Youth Theatre Ireland. So you're a leader in theatre for young audiences and young people, and you're currently working with Jodi and Eleanor. So how has your experience on this production built on that body of work for young people, and what you have to bring back to us in terms of learnings?
Yeah, great introductions, all right, as Petra said. And I now feel so bad that I'm following Jodi. But yeah, so like you mentioned, I worked in youth theatre for a long time. I still do. And I think part of the process of working in youth theatre is letting go of something and finding something else, you know. So you let go of having a budget, you let go of having a professional team, sometimes you let go of having an ego when you stand in front of a group of 14-year-olds and pretend you know what you're doing, and you find things again. And I think one of the things that you find is a very nurturing space, and you find that the work is about the people in the room having a good experience and bringing their best to a production and having a holistic approach. And the work is important, but the people in the room are as important as the work. And I think that's something that when I began to work making theatre for young audiences, And in any production room or rehearsal room I get into, it's something that I really value, is that the people in there make the experience. And I'm sure any of us who work in this sector, and we're all here because we work in this sector, it's really hard to get into the room. It can be really hard to get into a rehearsal room to get the funding or to get the job, you know, to be hired, to be in that position. And I've had experiences in the past when you get into the rehearsal room and it's not a good experience, and I never want to be in that room. And I think all the things that we're talking about now in terms of access and in terms of making the room a good place for people to be in, to do their best work. And that's something that we talked about. What do you need to do your best work? Was that, did Birds of Paradise give us that advice? Mm-hmm. Or?
Yeah, it could have been.
Yeah. And that was something I was trying to remember, you know, what do you need to do to do your best work? And that's a lot of what we talked about in terms of access. And then what else did you ask me, Charlotte?
So I suppose maybe to bring it back to what has been a joy in developing this work, and what is a place where you've been pushed in developing new languages or new skills in the room?
Yeah, like it was a really exciting script that Jodi presented, and I had no idea how to go about it. And I think I was clear with you in that, Jodi. I was a time I wanted to run away because I didn't feel I understood things enough. And Eleanor, what you were talking about, you know, making mistakes. I was afraid of making mistakes and making a mess of Jodi's beautiful idea. So that was one thing. And then you have to learn how to do it, and you have to learn how to do it on the job, as kind of everyone has said. So I had never worked using audio description. I'd never worked using captioning, never worked trying to embed access before in a production, never worked with welfare people on a team, a little bit in a youth theatre context. So there's a lot more people you've got to talk to, and there's a lot more communication that has to meet, and it can be dropped. And the thing that we're all talking about, Petra, you mentioned it first, is time. Having that time, and we actually had a lot of time in our planning, but then in the actualization from the day you get the funding decision to the day you're in the rehearsal room, sorry, that was 6 weeks, it wasn't to the opening. Mm. We were 6 weeks out and we didn't know 2 months before if we could make the piece. And all of the consideration we'd given to training and planning and embedding access and having the creative team meet earlier and meet access experts and do all that work, it just disappeared and we started making the work in crisis, I think, in terms of the timelines. And that's really frustrating because you've got this thing that you have put so much value in, that your funders have said, we value this, here's the money to do it, but we don't have the piece that we need to give it the consideration that we required. But then everyone is really invested. And then everyone resources the production with their own lives, because you're working in the evening and you're working at weekends and you're doing all these things because you want to make it happen. But that's not the way that we should be making work. Mm. Kieran, you said that beautiful thing about, you know, being seen on stage, and for us to create work where children see actors on stage that reflect them. That's really, really important. And that was a big thing for us going into this production. One thing that we do, like, I suppose, to talk about relaxed performances for a moment, we're kind of in the middle of this process still because the show is still on. And maybe in 6 months' time, we'll be in reflective mode. But now we're still kind of, we've still got the adrenaline coursing through us. But I was kind of thinking last night, you know, I think in Graffiti, we've been doing relaxed performances for a while, but I don't know if we knew what they were. Mm. Because when children walk up the road to come to the theatre, everyone in the administration and the office, like, it's a brilliant opportunity to stop sending emails and doing reports and going, oh, that's why we're making the work now, because there's children come to see it. So we always greet children as they come in. We always ask them to, you know, tell them they can relax and tell them that, you know, we introduce ourselves and we say, we're going to come back at the end of this show and we're going to have a chat and you'll meet the actors and you'll meet the team. And so we give a lot of information and a lot of welcome. And that's something you can do in every production, really, you know. There's that thing that happens then when you make this piece, you make the work and you get all the elements together, and then you've got to bring the show somewhere else. And so all of the work that's happened in your company over 2 months or 6 weeks, you have to arrive to another venue, and that understanding has to be brought with you. You know, so what does it mean? So what it means in your company to have a front of house that welcome children and that go, it's okay to behave as you need to behave, that has to be communicated in the next venue again, because they don't necessarily know, or they have a different understanding. And when we say, you can move if you need to move, you can make noise if you need to make noise, you can leave the theatre and you come back in, we mean that. That's an invitation that we mean. And if you go to another venue that doesn't quite understand or realize that, it's tricky. Yeah. It's tricky. And like we also talk about having relaxed. So when a child leaves, where do they go? They need a relaxed space to go. So all of these things are very, very important as well. So
I might do one brief follow-up there, Niall, before I come over to Grania. I mean, I'm really just moved by the vulnerability and the openness of all the folks on this panel about sharing what has worked, what has not worked, the courage to try. in those moments where what you're planning and then what the practice in the room, where there's a bump or there's a challenge and you are leading as the director, how did you deal with those moments of difficulty? How did you redirect or keep yourself calm to move the team forward?
I rang Jody. I rang Sive. No, like there's such goodwill and such everyone wants to make their best work, and everyone understood the importance of making this work, you know. And I think the work that Jody's making, the work that Petal's making, the work that Eleanor and Ciarán are making, like they are trailblazers. They're making work that other people aren't making, and we have to catch up with them, you know. And but I think just putting your hand up and saying there's a problem here now, how do we solve it? And we didn't think of this thing because we've never done it before, you know, or we've never done it before this way. So yeah, there's an incredible amount of learning, and I certainly don't claim any expertise at all, but I know more now than I did this time last year. And I know if I'm going into another production and I'm not including access to this level, I know it's missing, you know, and I know how to talk about it when I'm asking for it, you know. So there's, it's like kind of, it's a series of not hitting the thing you want to hit, but taking a step much closer to it and being able to articulate it much more and identify it much more than you were the previous time you did it, maybe.
And knowing who to call and who is in your support network.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that kind of occurred to me is that if we don't like write this down, that there's no real learning left from it. You know, I mean, it's great that we're having this conversation here now with a small group of people, but I think that there's probably a value in the kind of post-production aspect of it, where you start to actually catalogue, okay, well, what are the steps? So me and Mo are going to sit down, okay, what are the steps? How would we do it differently the next time in terms of embedding those things? So I think we make work so much of the time in crisis mode, and then we move on to the next thing because most of us are freelancers and we therefore have to pay rent. And so we just move on to the next thing. And then there isn't like the Bible of access to go back to that I know of or that I've discovered. But also then it shouldn't necessarily be the responsibility of us to write it for free. But it's just kind of how do we collate those learnings and how do we then put in place kind of a sort of a best practice system in terms of like that other people could refer to as well if they were going to make this kind of work. So that's something I'm kind of mulling over.
I think it's really important, Jody. And as you were speaking, I was going, yeah, we do. And I've never articulated it as clearly as you have, but all of the points in terms of we have to have somebody coordinate all the transport, all the access. Then we have somebody who takes care of our actors. We've used inner ear, we've used prompting depending on the piece. And I really, really think that when you're putting access into a piece that you have to start right back at that first scene.
In terms of the big picture, in terms of where are we in the industry, in terms of what's working, where are we in a state of crisis? We have the fantastic Grainne Pollock here from Safe to Create. Grainne is the project manager for Safe to Create, which is a dignity at work program looking to transform workplace culture and practices and to provide safe and respectful working conditions for those working in the Irish arts and creative sectors. She is a multilingual producer and arts and project manager from Dublin. She's worked across Ireland and the UK for companies and festivals, as well as an arts administrator in venues within the arts and beyond. So you are one of the leaders behind our Safe to Create's recent groundbreaking and unfortunately harrowing Amplify report. This was released in July 2024, and the findings revealed that, quote, disabled LGBTQIA+ and ethnically diverse artists and arts workers are experiencing discrimination, exclusion, and other harmful behaviors and challenging conditions in Ireland's arts and creative sector. And that moreover, quote, the burden of improving conditions falls on the minoritized artists and art workers themselves, end quote. We've heard some of the vision and steps for practical achievement from the artists on the panel today, but of course we need to be doing more together regardless of our own minority or not status. So take us back to the beginning in terms of how you designed and carried out this survey. how did you maximize the inclusivity of who could participate and how they could contribute?
Sure. So just very briefly for the context of what the Amplify report is, for anyone who doesn't know, in the original Speak Up report, which gave rise to the whole Safe to Create program, which was published in 2021, and it was recognized after that report was released that there were gaps in that data and that we didn't capture sufficient data around the experiences of LGBT, disabled and ethnically and racially marginalized artists and arts workers. So in early 2023, we sought to redress that, basically. So we began kind of an 18-month process, I suppose, around capturing those experiences of harmful behavior in the sector, but particularly how they intersect with these three communities and the intersectionality between those communities as well. So from the outset, we were kind of like, this is going to be a substantial piece of research. We don't want to do this tokenistically. We don't want to do this in a tick box way because it's pointless. We won't get the data that we need. So from the beginning, we really tried very kind of consistently to center the voices and the lived experiences of these individuals who are directly impacted in the way that the findings came to show. So, and those experiences did end up framing the backbone of our findings. So to begin with, we started by hosting a series of focus groups with the different groupings of artists. This was through call out and invitation, a combination of, we just tried to get as many artists and arts workers across art forms as possible into the room to talk to us about their experiences. Because we also recognized that within the research team and the Safe to Create team, we were a relatively homogenous group, so we weren't about to decide what the questions should be. We also had lengthy conversations with expert organizations, people like Petal at Blue Teapot, Carolyn Lockman at KCAT was instrumental. We brought in the fantastic Rachel Parry, who is here today, to help specifically looking at the ID experience, the intellectually disabled experience. So we had kind of this range of conversations that then fed into drafts of the initial survey design. So the different questions that we should be asking based on the experiences. And then once we put those together, we fed them back to the people we'd already consulted with for feedback, took that on board, honed the questions, tweaked them. And at that point, then we had extensive testing to make sure the user experience was accessible. And we came up against serious issues there. So it's good that we did that process. And it did mean that we ended up stretching out the timeframe quite significantly compared to what we had originally intended. And then while we were having these conversations, we actually decided to conduct a separate strand of research specifically around the intellectually disabled experience. And from our conversations with people like Blue Teapot and KCAT, we came to realize that the questions that we had devised would not work in the context of artists with intellectual disabilities. And we actually ended up dividing those surveys out into four separate surveys. So we had five in total. We had the larger survey. We had one for intellectually disabled artists, which was available in Easy Read. One for their family members and guardians, one for facilitators who work with them, and then one for organizations. So we were capturing this whole range of experience as thoroughly as we could. And we ended up putting all the surveys out into the field for 10 weeks. So it was kind of longer than usual, I think, again, from the advice given to us by these organizations and individuals. We also realized that in trying to be really thorough with the questions we were asking, the survey was incredibly long and we really feared that that would be an access barrier. So we made it possible to take breaks and come back. And actually, in the end, the follow through rate was like really high, particularly from those with disabilities, which was really interesting to us. So our fears were assuaged. We also had a helpline available throughout if anyone needed to call, pick up the phone, ask a question or ask someone to guide them through the whole survey process. We had a video guide, which we created with an ISL interpreter and captions. In general, the whole thing was just much more slow paced and a deliberate approach. That was kind of the consistent thing throughout. When the time came then to write the report itself, to pull the findings down, we put together a panel of experts from the communities again to directly feed into the recommendations, which is the most important part of any research. We consulted at length with them back and forth about, you know, does this work? Is this too jargony? Tell us honestly. And they were brilliant. They told us, look, that you're saying loads of words there, but you're not actually committing to anything. So that consultation was really important. And then finally, when the time came to launch the report, we were really keen to keep the artists from these communities at the forefront and platform their voices. So we launched the report at an event in July. And for that, we actually commissioned Nigerian Irish artist Feli Speaks to respond directly to the findings and to create a performance piece, which we then filmed and screened at the launch. And our MC, our panel, our In Conversation, and then we had a musical performance. They were all individuals who were from the communities experiencing these difficulties and had fed into the research themselves. So it was really just keeping them to the forefront the whole way through.
So that is a lot in terms of what you were able to make happen and the supports needed in place to make that happen. Is there any learning on how you were able to make the case, get the funding for that kind of an experience that we could take forward here?
Yeah, I mean, the learnings, we're coming back to time, like it's coming up time and time again, and it is, the title of the panel says it all. You know, I think in this sector, the temptation is to just plow on as fast as possible, as much output as possible. We don't stop and think, we don't stop and consider. There's very little space for thoughtfulness and carefulness. And I think we realized quite quickly that it was naive of us to think that we could just rush this thing out into the world. And much as that was stressful at the time when a timeline doesn't work out, accepting it was very empowering because you were like, okay, actually, this is the right way to do this. So yeah, time and space, absolutely paramount. Now, I know that's a luxury, and we were lucky enough to not have a production deadline, for example, or an opening night that we were working towards. We were able to push it out with the rationale that we were trying to do it right, essentially. One of the biggest things, and I think, Eleanor, you hinted at this, that we learned, and I say it to everyone because we get a lot of people approaching us now wanting to work in this space or conduct research or engage with these communities. And I think it is absolutely crucial to have a consistently humble mindset and to be able and willing to put your hands up and say, I don't know, or I got that wrong, I messed that up. There's no space for ego. And I think what Eleanor, you were saying about this fear of getting things wrong, it can be so paralyzing. And actually, I'm just going to be really upfront on this. I don't think it's good enough, particularly people with positions of power who say, look, I just don't really know about it, so I'm not going to engage with it. It's not good enough. So I think just being open to listening and hearing from the people with the lived experience and not, you know, overly drawing on their time or their resources, but just being open and properly listening, like genuinely listening. It's easier said than done, but it's like at the core of this and putting your ego to one side and saying, I don't get this, help me out here. It's impossible to do the kind of work that we did cheaply. I just have to say it. And we luckily have a decent budget for the overall project directly from the department for the arts. And we basically made the decision to dedicate a significant chunk of it over the past 18 months to this project. So yeah, we were able to do that. And it's, you know, that's in large part why it was successful in the way that it was, I would say. I think another really important thing to remember is that there's what we discovered is there's already incredible, passionate, driven people out there doing this work. People like Jodie, people like Eleanor, who have learned along the way, who have lived experience and who are actively and practically implementing it. So we shouldn't be trying to reinvent the wheel here. You know, it's like reach out, collaborate. Collaboration is so crucial because, yeah, the work is being done, but it's maybe just happening on the margins, excuse the expression, but it's not to the forefront and it's not being valued sufficiently. I was struck by, I think, Niall, you said it in last year's panel about you meet one autistic person, it means you've met one autistic person. And this idea, or was it Jody?
I miss both of Jody.
You miss, but that's what it was. Yeah. So, you know, one disabled person's experience does not equate to another disabled person's experience. It's not a homogenous group of people. Like, one in five people in this country identify as having disabilities. So how could it be a homogenous group of people? And I just think it's really important to be open to that and to respond to that accordingly. And then finally, the last thing I'll say, sorry, I've been going on for too long, is that alluding to what Eleanor mentioned, these issues that we're discussing and that we're trying to tackle, they're systemic and they're interconnected, and they're not actually isolated to our sector. And so without kind of large scale joined up thinking and intergovernmental department action and thinking and planning, and really like an overhaul of policy and systems, we can't do this work in a meaningful way. And things like Eleanor mentioned around social welfare payments, stopping people from being able to work sufficiently, it's, you know, that's really fundamental stuff that we are actively now putting into an action plan for next year. We're planning an assembly of NGO groups, arts organizations, government departments, to kind of citizens assembly style, actually get people in the same room to talk about, okay, what needs to change? How do we do this? What's already happening? Yeah, it's bigger than just us, I think.
So before I open it up to the panel to ask questions of each other, and then you all to ask questions to the panel, are there any particular findings from the theatre for young audiences sector who are interested in making inclusive art that you would like to highlight or to push to us in terms of what we need to pay attention to, where we need to act?
Not specifically to theatre for young audiences, but I just think it's very interesting that all of our findings basically confirm everything that we've been discussing today, in terms of there's a real parallel between our process of the design of the research and this inclusive, slow, adapted method of working that these guys have done with Grace and that Blue Teapot work with, that they are the way forward with this work, and probably even more so with theatre for young audiences, and that policymakers and funders need to adapt their systems to accommodate this. Yeah, I could go into practical recommendations, but actually, Jodie, you've covered a huge amount of them. But just one thing I did want to say is that we have a huge number of recommendations in this report. It's massive, so I don't expect people to read it. But we also have an easy read version of it. We have a plain English summary of it. I have a few copies here if anyone desperately wants one. I don't really want to take them back to Dublin on the train, so please do ask me for them. But they're all available on our website and via the QR code. So there's a huge number of recommendations which we are now putting into practice as part of an action plan for next year. But one of the things is we want to develop this hub of knowledge with glossaries and guidelines, and basically recording all of this stuff that can then be available to others for use, so that there's no excuse as to, well, I don't know how to do it. So just to say, Jodie, I'd love to actually talk about how we pay you to do that, because that, I'm sorry, that's something I should have mentioned about the Amplify process. Everyone we consulted with was paid the whole way along, so that is something I shouldn't have to say it out loud, but unfortunately I think I do, that if you're going to draw on people's expertise, you pay them appropriately.
There's a lot of conversations to continue here and keep the pressure up. Join me in thanking the panelists for sharing their time today, the audience for hearing your experience as well. Thank you.